Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water blessed by St. Keurig. And today, we have another union member with me to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Welcome, Carl Rodriguez.
Hello, thanks for having me, Jason. I have my Dungeon Plunger card here. There, see, you saw it.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Legitimate. Question, do you guys have
you should make like little like Dungeon Plunger union cards? That'd be kind of fun.
That would be awesome. I definitely
like little merch when you get as you grow, because you're growing pretty quickly. I think it's pretty cool. I think you have a really great like radio voice.
I appreciate that.
I've definitely
thought about the merch kind of idea. One idea that I thought of would be to have like you know how you have like dice jails?
Yeah, those are cool. Like a toilet.
Exactly, right?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
So that's like a place for shitty dice to go.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I think there's already something like that, but you know, I need to brand it and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you could figure out, I mean, I'm sure you could find someone in the verse that could do that, or make it like a STL so you could 3D print something like that. And then,
yeah.
Or even paint it yourself.
There you go, man.
Is it going to be white porcelain, all shiny and chrome and clean? Or is it going to be, you know, like the toilets and train spotting, which I still have really bad memories about? Or Fight Club, for that matter. It's like the same trigger, which is really weird during toilets.
Yeah, I agree. So just for those of my listeners who don't really know who you might be, I mean, we've been friends for a little bit now.
Yeah.
And so
thanks to Shay Webster of Roleplay Rescue.
Uniting gamers.
All over the world.
Exactly.
That should be his little motto.
Yep, I agree. I'll pass it.
Or rescuing gamers from all over the world. Maybe that is part of his thing. I love Shay.
Yeah, Che. Well, so that's the thing. You and Che were like two of the people that really like championed the idea that I start my own podcast. So I owe a debt of gratitude to you and a debt of gratitude to him. So, yeah. So tell us who are you, Carl?
So I am Carl Rodriguez, a gemologist. Might be a little bit of a prideful title, but it's a play on the fact that I do have a PhD, not in gaming or gaming products. It's a PhD in molecular biology, but then, you know, ologist, so biology, molecular biology, GM, gemologist. So I put that together. I checked around, and sometimes if you put gemologist, you might get gemologist as a Google correction, but I'm not a gemologist. I don't do any geology or gem cutting. I guess what's a gemologist do? They probably study more the properties of gems and try to make him into lasers or something. But you know, gemologist kind of was cool and it stuck. And I've been playing for a game for a long time. I started with the Molde box set and the monster manual that I picked up of all places at Michael's. I don't know if you guys have Michael's up in Canada. Or
is that an art store?
It's an art, little art and hobby store. They had like the D&D stuff for sale at one point in their incarnation. So it's like a hobby shop, right? So I got the Molde basic for Christmas. My mom and dad actually got it for me, and this is before Satanic Panic and all that, but I guess they'd always sort of encourage our creativity, right? So I started with, probably at that point, probably not Lord of the Rings just yet, The Hobbit definitely, because we actually read in our reading, sixth grade reading class, we actually read excerpts from The Hobbit, and then I went back and read the whole thing. But then definitely Chronicles of Narnia was a big starting point for fantasy literature as a young, I guess it's YA, right? It's sixth grade YA. 11 years old, I guess it is. It the beginning. Like... Yeah. So, you know, and then I was into, I'd just gotten into like heavy metal at the time too, thanks to some neighbors. Like, so Led Zeppelin and Rush, Judas Priest, but especially Rush and Led Zeppelin had, you know, Led Zeppelin with, you know, references to the Lord of the Rings, honestly. And then Rush with like epic 2112 type stuff, or, you know, earlier stuff like Fly By Night by Tor and the Snow Dog, the Necromancer from Crest of Steel. So all that kind of stuff, right? It was like, oh, wow, this is so cool. And what is this about? So then, and then I think I got into like Conan shortly after that. So Robert Howard, Conan stuff. And then, you know, playing the D&D that kind of fed in. So I've been playing for a long time. More or less, I would say more or less continuously through middle school, then to high school, various games, and then college, even, you know, though that was, I probably should have focused more on studies, but, you know, it happens. There's probably like a break after that in the 20s, but then jump back into it with the 3.0 and the like. So I've been playing for a while. I run a lot of games. That's what I just got a call from Connerly, you know, because I just talked about like what's next, because there's several of my games are like ending a cycle or a series or a chapter or even the adventure, right? And I just talked about what's happening next, and Connerly's like, you run a lot of games. So,
yeah, I definitely wanted to talk about that, because I agree that it's really impressive, your resume of what you're doing. So
it's kinda... my mom would call hyperactivity, but it's more, honestly, I'll be honest with you and your listeners, ADHD.
Yeah.
So it feeds into that, right? It is jumping from game to game and not being satisfied for how this game is going, or looking at the latest butterfly, squirrel, you know.
But you seem to actually be able to like keep these games going. Like, one of the things that I've had the experience of, because I definitely, you know, suffer from the shiny new thing. And so it's kind of like you're like, I would start a game and then I would get distracted by something else. And then that game would fall by the wayside and we'd say, oh, yeah, we're going to go back to it. But we never really would go back to it. You seem to be able to do that.
Well, I guess that's what's like known, right? So like with my home group, for example, we did bounce off games here and there, especially during the COVID times. Some of that might have been due to like people not getting or liking VTT, but still, there was like we played like a game for a session, didn't even finish the adventure, try something else, play a few sessions, try something else until something finally like sticks or stuck in that case. So you know, it's not always the case, which is kind of interesting, right? Kind of interesting that, and that is a topic in and of itself, like why do some games stick, why do some fall by the wayside, what happens, and you know, it's part interest and part scheduling, honestly. Right.
Yeah. So. No, I agree. I've definitely had that same feeling. I just finished my Stars Without Numbers game, so yep. We're calling it like season one.
Oh yeah. That's a great idea, because sometimes you're like, oh man, we finished this sort of story. And I think that's a great idea and a great suggestion to GMs to really find if there's a logical pause and, you know, people want to move on to something else because of the latest, greatest, the most shiny, or even like if you're in a group where you rotate GMs, hey, just run an adventure, run a season. It doesn't have to be a one-shot story arc. Then stop for a little bit, and then that kind of leaves it open so that, hey, we finished the story, and if we want to come back to it, then we have that on the horizon or in the future. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, it felt that was sort of the conversation that was had at the end of the session, because I actually wasn't prepared to end the campaign. It was kind of like a, hey guys, like, you know, we've been planning to start Masks of Nyarlathotep, and I'm not opposed to continuing this game. I'm just saying that, like, if the next session that we do, it feels like we're going to be starting up like a new sort of arc sort of thing. And this felt like a nice closure to what they were doing. And everybody sort of agreed, like, yeah, this has been such a great campaign and we definitely want to continue. But yeah, we've sort of ended on a high note. So maybe this is a good spot to end it. And it was kind of like a downer on the one sense for me. Like, I wasn't really prepared. Like, the next morning, I was kind of like, wow, man, like, we've done a year and a bit of this game and now we're kind of moving on, you know. So have you had that same experience?
I think recently, especially, like, we talked about before we started recording Twilight 2000, and I know your group's going to be starting that up, and we've been running that for, I would say, almost 5 years. I think I started 2020 on my as a birthday game, and it's kind of we did the original sort of tetralogy that GDW came up with in the first edition, Twilight 2000, sort of the prologue being you're on your own, which you'll hopefully similarly experience when you play, and then Free City of Krakow, Pirates of the Vistula, Ruins of Warsaw, and Black Madonna, that we flip-flop those two. And they've redone some of those in the new products, and they've modified them. So if you are a Grognard like me who played or is familiar with those old ones, then you can play these new ones and it'll be a different experience, which I think is a good idea. Instead of just rehashing the adventures or whatever, just make it different and change things around. But we just came to the end of our season one, the year 2000, as it were. And, you know, we came to the winter time. We did a Christmas, what happens at Christmas, and then we're gonna stop. There's a revelation with one of the characters. We're gonna put a pause on that for a little bit. And I would like to jump back to that. I know one of the players is keen on jumping back to that. I think I could tell some of the other players are kind of, you know, they need a break because it's kind of intense, serious kind of post-fictitious World War III stuff. So sometimes you need a break from that. And it was a really great end to a long ongoing story. So now that's, I guess, the year 2000, season one, whatever you want to call it. And then now we're going to retool and see what's going to happen in the future. In the meantime, we jump to another game that we might play for a little bit or a long time, so we'll see.
Okay. That sounds really awesome. Like, I just feel that sense of satisfaction of like this came to a, because I feel like we have that feeling as game masters so often where you have grand ideas and then, like you said, they just, for whatever reason, they don't launch. And then you have that sense of feeling like, oh, am I a bad game master? Like, why can't I make this work? Why can't I run a good game that lasts? And I don't know if that's necessarily like a good marker of success as, you know, being a game master.
Well, sometimes like we just mentioned a few minutes ago, you know, you rotate games. Sometimes you rotate games and see what sticks, right? Or it just doesn't work well for whatever reason. I can say recently, like, I've been trying to get an ongoing, like, a traditional Call of Cthulhu game for some time, and I don't know what it is. I mean, it's been great doing like little dual one-on-one games with Amy, and then doing like a little story here and there, like an adventure or two, but nothing like a long-term like Masks or many of the other stories that are out there. So that's why I kind of came up with this idea to do it a little different, and maybe that would attract the players or have players in a different kind of mindset. I don't know. I think one of my problem, and this is not to slight my players, it's just the way people play and people are, and maybe it's just the reputation of Cthulhu is, I mean, I guess I want to delve into like serious psychological horror. Maybe that's a little too intense, and some people get it and some people want to, you know, make funny memes, and that annoys me, so we're just not going to play this game. So think about doing something else, and that's for me, right? So I don't think that means you're a bad GM. It's just that's not what you want, and you as a GM have to have as much fun as the players, right?
I just think that it's a coping mechanism, right? I think some people are that's how they deal with senses, like that feeling of uneasiness, and so they crack the jokes and try to bring the levity, and yeah, it's not necessary, like if that's the kind of game that you're trying to run where it's serious and, you know, that's going to ruin it, right?
Not to say we don't laugh during the game, but it's like, I feel like I'd love to see it as more like gallows humor or in-game joking, right? Like someone makes, even if they make like a funny Star Wars or Aliens, say, you know, quote, but it fits within the context of the game, and it's not like, in my opinion, out from left field. Yeah, that's just me, right? But then, like we were saying, you know, other like let's see, what are the games we bounced off of? Like I was mentioning, so we tried Soulbound, which is like if you're familiar with the Games Workshop 40K and Old World universe, they scrubbed the Old World in this big cataclysmic thing, and they created this Age of Sigmar, which fit in with their, like, we want to go from, instead of rank and file type of battles, we want to go to skirmish like we do in 40K. People like it, people don't. There's a lot of outrage, of course. But Soulbound is a role-playing game based on the Age of Sigmar verse. And I think it's a really cool fantasy verse. And it just, for whatever reason, it didn't work. And I think it's a fine system. I think it's really, the art is amazing because it's all Games Workshop sponsored art or licensed art is pretty cool. And it's just a different world that the players just didn't like it. We tried, this is one campaign for 5e called Odyssey of the Dragon Lord. So kind of like Greek-inspired 5e fantasy. And we played one adventure, and it was all right. I mean, I guess I didn't. I think it was, for me personally, it was hard because all the players wanted to play like strange creatures, and maybe that's the appeal, right? In a game like 5e, I want to play a centaur. I want to play. So there was like a centaur, a harpy, a satyr, a dragonborn, which is kind of, it fit, but it was kind of weird for a Greek themed. But and then there was a minotaur. So they're like, I just called them the misfits, you know? And so for me, so like, you know, so really when they go into town, people be like, okay, who are these people? They're very strange. Like, but I guess maybe they didn't like it. Maybe that's what I was trying to project, and that didn't go over well, but so it got kind of stalled, I think. Despite the fact that it's a pretty neat setup and premise, and I think what I liked about it too is like it gave characters like sort of long-term motivations, which isn't super common, and like they have a backstory and a history and they roll it randomly or they choose it, and then this is kind of like comes up in different adventures. Like if this is your legacy, then this happens in this adventure, or this can happen, or if you follow this path, you know, it's kind of neat setup. But
okay. Do you prefer gaming in person or online? Because I feel like you do most of your gaming online. Is that right?
Well, I have my home group, which is in person. And yeah, I think most of it is online though now. Yeah, because I just have a Thursday group that we meet more or less every week and run a couple games. That's been going on for a while too. But then most everything else is online with you guys.
Do you have a preference?
It'd be great to play in person, or if technology were such that it'd be like all like, you know, virtual and it seemed in person as opposed to, yeah.
So like, are you talking like if we could do like the holodeck type of
scenario? That'd be kind of cool. Yeah.
Interesting.
Or even a holodeck and sit around at the table in game, right?
Yeah, that would be interesting. No, like imagine a Star Trek Next Gen episode where instead of they were all sitting around the table playing poker, they were all like role playing. I guess that's kind of what those holodeck episodes really were. But
yeah, the ones where Picard is a private eye, right? So that type of thing. But then something else always goes freaky, and it becomes not less a game and more like lethal, right? So, but yeah, I'm sure like a lower deck. Well, there's lower decks is over, but if they do like a live action Lower Decks, that could be cool if they did something like that.
Yeah, let's hope our like role playing games online never become lethal. That would be scary. What's your favorite RPG or system of the moment, since you, because you've played a lot, like we've talked, and you just, your knowledge is pretty huge. Like you've played a lot of games, you know a lot of games. Where are you at today?
I think my favorite game right now, and I apologize any of my players and other games who listen to this, I think it's the One Ring right now. I really do. It's the One Ring from Free League One Ring, right? Yeah, I just think that, I don't know, for whatever reason, Lord of the Rings is still in the zeitgeist, despite Rings of Power getting mixed reviews, and that the other cartoon movie, War of the Rohirrim, which actually I thought was pretty good, but people, you know, lashed out at it.
Really? I thought that it had gotten pretty good reviews.
It didn't do well at the box office, because of because of negative press, but I think it did, you're right, maybe it did get really good reviews. I mean, I thought it was neat, because it definitely doesn't break canon, but the focus, I think, and I think it's like a tale from a spectator watching the events as they happen, right? It's not about, the focus isn't the main hero, it's like a relative of the main hero, and maybe that was the issue. They would have wanted it to be taken from the perspective of Helm Hammerhand, I guess.
But it's also an anime, right?
Yeah, it's like an anime.
I guess maybe that might turn certain people off, depending on what they think visually, you know, that genre should look like.
Have you watched Lord of the Rings? I mean, how realistic is it for someone like Legolas, Gimli, Aragorn to survive those types of onslaughts? They're pretty spectacular, right? So I think it's, so like showing Helm like that type of level of heroism is pretty damn cool, I think.
Right. I just meant more like the artistic style.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I guess that might turn people off, but
yeah. What's your take on the One Ring, the Rings of Power? I mean,
I think they could have done it better. I mean, the time dilation is always going to be an issue, right? Even in the Lord of the Rings movies, right? You know that the time between Bilbo's 1191st and the actual start is like 10 years, right? And it looks like that on the screen. Might be actually longer. I'm not sure. I don't remember. Someone will correct me.
Wait, so you're saying that the time from his birthday to the end of that trilogy is 10 years?
So the time of his birthday, the 1191st birthday, and then when, you know, Gandalf comes back and says, is it secret? Is it safe? And he leaves the Shire is like...
That's 10 years past?
It might be even more.
Wow, I had no idea. I knew obviously time passed. I didn't realize it was that much time.
Yeah. While we're talking, I'll probably look up Lord of the Rings timeline. But yeah, so like the time, you know, so the time between like The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is like 40 years or so.
Okay.
Like
that. Yeah, that seemed reasonable.
The Free League is at the One Ring sort of in the middle. So, right. So if you follow any Third Age chronology, so let's say 2941 is The Hobbit. 2950 to 2960 is the One Ring, and then like 3000 is the you know, the end of the Lord of the Rings, and towards the end of the Third Age, maybe even past that, right? So it's like there's a lot of time. So the time dilation, and then of course in the Rings of Power, that's like Second Age, and that's like hundreds and hundreds. That's hundreds of years, right? And it doesn't seem like that. And even so, I understand, right, it's a movie. People aren't going to get that. I mean, and it wouldn't matter anyway for men. It would matter, but not really, because they're Numenorean, right? But and they're long lived. But some of the minor characters, the non Numenorean humans, they'd be getting old and dying out, and you'd have this. So yeah, I can see that. But they just got some of the order of events wrong, and that kind of bothered me. you can, there's plenty of, you guys can go look that up. There's plenty of material on how they mess those types of things up. And I don't mind if, so yeah, there's quite a bit.
So tell me a little bit about the One Ring. Like, if I was going to get into it today, what would I need to know?
Right. How familiar are you? I guess the first question is, how familiar are you with other Free League games?
So I briefly looked at Forbidden Lands. Yes.
Free League games, it's not the same Mutant Year Zero engine at all, right? Which is a dice pool of D6. It's kind of like a descendant of the original Cubicle 7 One Ring, which is a D12 and a series of D6s to hit a target number. So it's more akin to, like, say, if you're familiar with the 4th edition L5R, we have pools of D10s and you got to hit a target number, right? Or something like that. A Song of Ice and Fire does that too. Pool of dice, hit a target number. So it's similar to that. Use D12s and D6s. But it does have that sort of Free League procedural that people are familiar with. So it breaks things down into different modules, if you will, where you have like an adventuring, or phases, that's what the term they use, like adventuring phase, an action phase, exploration phase, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, there's a fellowship phase. So, right, it breaks those things down. And then within those, say, for example, the exploration stuff or the travel stuff, you go through this procedure. And I like that. I think that kind of harkens back to me to like BX, for example, where you have procedures for you know, traveling through hexes. And that's kind of essentially what it is. And that's what I think is a cool thing about the One Ring. Is really there, you know, you can just explore the world and go through these procedures and run into trouble. And I've kind of taken somewhat that approach. And then they have like, it's more location based as opposed to an adventure path, although they do have a adventures and adventure path type of formats as well. But you could just, I think that's what I like. It's an open world, right? It's this idea of an open world and hex crawl, which I love from like a old school game type perspective. They have a procedure, a very standard procedure for it that everyone gets into. And then, you know, it reminds me of the old, I don't know if you remember those old gold box games from SSI, where you play Forgotten Realms or like Pool of Radiance and all those kind of things. So some of your listeners will probably remember that, but then it jumps to like, you know, from that during the adventuring phase, you explore for a while, some encounter happens and you like jump to that type of phase, right? So, and there's a procedure for that too, which I think makes game flow work really well. And I also feel like they've done a great job with even in the books themselves with the layout, and again, site-based, the art is pretty incredible. It's like this sort of sepia sketch art. And also highlighted by, you know, the, like, if you look at many Free League books, they have this sort of three-quarter or like 1.5-page spread at each beginning of each chapter, or a full page at each chapter. So they're very beautiful books too, which I think is a draw, that you can show at the table or you know, screenshot it and show it on VTT, which kind of brings the mood. And I think that's the main thing that we have observed, is that it really captures the mood of that time period, that sort of desperation, you know, shadow is coming time period between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, End of the Third Age. So I think it does a great job of that. And it could do a great job, I think, of any, most of the time periods where there's a lot of strife. So if you wanted to go back, and I know one of my players, as an interlude, we might do like a callback using... So they just put out a book where you can make an elf lord. So like have a couple crazy elf lords who are very powerful, do cool stuff sort of at the beginning of the third age or end of the second age or something like that. So you could do it during a time of strife. It probably doesn't work as well for, it might not work as well for first age because of the high magic involved. it might not work as well for like sort of the time of peace. But then you have a lot of material for that from other books, and you could make it work. You could always find conflict and strife, right? in any age and time period. So you have a lot of material from MERP that you can draw on, and maybe even use MERP for the high magic. Yeah, Middle Earth role playing. So based on Rolemaster, like it's Rolemaster Lite. Use some of the MERP stuff for the high, if you want to play like high magic or lots of creatures. So in like again, the First Age or something like that, where there's a lot of monsters and high magic and, you know, elves are leveling mountains or whatever.
Cool. So that kind of brings me to my next sort of question, which is, let's say I'm a casual, Lord of the Rings lover. I've seen the movies. Maybe I've seen the Hobbit movies. How much does a person really need to know? Like, could you come into this game with like zero? Let's say you've never read even the Hobbit, or watched the movies.
Yeah, you're fine. If you haven't watched the movies, I mean, you might know what to do. I don't know.
But do you think it's more?
I don't know. Would a person who've never watched the movies want to play this? I don't know.
It's a good question. I just wonder, people play Dungeons and Dragons, and there is an implicit setting that's sort of based on the books, right? But okay, so like if you were like, hey, I'm interested in role playing games, and for some reason you didn't start with D&D and you saw like, hey, what's this One Ring game? This looks interesting, and you just picked it up, and would you just be able to be like, oh, wow, I have enough information in here to actually, start running a game?
Yeah, you definitely have enough. You definitely would have enough information to run the game. There's also both Cubicle 7 and Free League also have a 5e version.
Oh, so interesting.
Even if you're familiar with Dungeons and Dragons, then you could jump in with the 5e version. Now, I have run both. Yeah. So I feel I didn't answer your question. So if you want to just play the One Ring, the Free League proprietary system, you probably just need the CRB, honestly. It's got a lot of information on the region, like the Northern Arnor, the Rhyadar region, Old Arnor, and then Rhyadar region. So the stuff that's not in the books, really, except for the Shire. If you just wanted to run a fun, happy-go-lucky one shot, you could run the starter set, which takes place all in the Shire. You play a bunch of hobbits, so you could do that. And I think someone familiar with fantasy role playing, where they see elves and dwarves and hobbits, halflings, humans, right? So, but then there, it's a little different because there's not, magic is lower, there's still magic and it can be very powerful, but it's more subtle, right? And it's more harkens to a previous age where this crafting was done, and that is, so like most of the magic is like elven, dwarven, old human artifacts. Like there's nothing new, right? Which is kind of interesting, right? In a way. So that'd be the aesthetic. And I would say, going to your next question about comparing the two, I honestly feel playing both and playing with players who had various levels of familiarity with the Lord of the Rings verse, with Tolkien's verse, that someone who is more of a casual fan, seen the movies, maybe not seen all of them, bounced off them, whatever, is going to play it more like 5e and not really understand, I felt not really understand like the weight of what's going on. And I feel that's a 5e version. It doesn't really right. So there's always mechanics for corruption in games and shadow sanity, all that kind of stuff. And some games do a really great job of showing that decline. Like I say, Delta Green, phenomenal job of showing your loss of humanity, your loss of sanity, really. And I would say Call of Cthulhu does a moderate job of it, like base Call of Cthulhu. But I would say that the One Ring the cubicle, or sorry, the Free League version, their proprietary rule system, it really, you feel, because there's an intertwine between, you know, your meta currency, your hope, and the way they, what they call it, even hope, right, versus falling into despair, falling into shadow, you know, becoming weary because of the weight of the world and that's on you. And travel is hard, right? So if you go on a long journey, you're gonna feel like crap, you know, and then you recover, like in Rivendell or whatever, right? So, but you know, but traveling over Caradhras, like the Misty Mountains, that's gonna tax you severely. Right, and you see that in the movies, right? You see that in the, you know, I read that in the books, but I would say, like, unfortunately, 5e, it just comes down to like a die roll, right? So while you accumulate this loss of endurance, for example, this is an example, during your travel phase in the One Ring game, and then at the end you kind of recover briefly if you can find like a place to camp out, but it still like lingers, right? Same thing with shadow and hope. Right, so you use hope because that gives you bonuses, and you want to succeed, and it's a player choice, important choices whether you're gonna use hope, but then if you run into shadow, then if those two collide, then you're gonna become miserable, and it could lead to like issues role playing opportunities for your character, and in the 5e version, unfortunately, it's just a die roll at the end of the journey. I'll roll my endurance save. Or my constitution save, right? Or for the, and there's no intertwine between the hope meta currency, because they just use inspiration like you would in 5e. And then shadow is just, again, a will save or a wisdom save, wisdom, charisma, intelligence save, right? So it just kind of boils it down to like a roll, yes or no, as opposed to like this accumulation, which I think mirrors the time period a lot better. So, and also, and I could tell that too, because like I had one player who's played both, and they were like, yeah, you could totally tell how different the feel is in these two games. Really, the 5e version, unless you have like 100% character buy-in, just feels like D&D with, you know, Lord of the Rings tacked on in a way. Right, and I think I would say 1.5 of the players got it, but then some of the other players, when I was running it, fell into their old sort of D&D tropes and patterns. Well, I'm not necessarily the sorry, there's a fly. So if I'm doing this with a fly, sorry about that, YouTubers watchers. But anyway, so like, so for example, there is like this calling. They call the classes callings called Treasure Hunter. And this one guy, one player who usually plays rogues, he opted for, instead of a hobbit, a man, a Bree, right? So like a normal human, not a, like a Dunedain or Numenorean descendant. And he's like, oh, I'll be a treasure finder. So he kind of basically fell into his rogue tropes. So I'm going to pickpocket people and steal things. And that's, and if you do that in, if you do that, that's not a, right. There's consequences in the Lord of the Rings universe for stuff like that, right? And I think they just didn't get it. But they fell into their old D&D tropes, right? And I think it's the weight of it. So if you, like, again, if you, maybe I should hear your counterpoint first.
Well, I was just gonna say, I feel like, you know, there's always a lot of talk in the gaming community about how system matter, right? And I feel like this is a great point of where system does matter, you know?
Yes, it does. I think like that player, if you would have been like, oh, I want to use my hope. Oh, wait, I'm getting shadow. Oh, this is going to be bad if these things mesh. Or, you know, you effectively, like, if you have more shadow than you have hope left, you become miserable. And that becomes, even if you're not really thinking about it, like in my role-playing sense, mechanically, that's going to hurt you, right? I would say a person who is into the more mechanics is going to be, man, this is bad for my character, right? and some the role player is going to be like, oh, it's a great role playing opportunity. I can mitigate this using a scar that I take, or really fall, or let me succumb to the shadow, and then I'll have a crisis, right? And then that's a great, you know, like you go mad, or you have a madness bout in like Pendragon, or you go it's not temporarily insane, it's the other one. One where you're like, the second tier of loss of sanity in Call of Cthulhu.
Okay, like a temporary madness kind of thing?
Yeah. A temporary bout of madness, yeah. Yeah, so where you're out for like hours or whatever. But so you could, something like that can happen, and that's a great opportunity. And I think the One Ring, really the proprietary system, feeds into that, promotes that. And the 5e version, it's going to really take some dedicated players who really enjoy the 5e and want to make it work to really, because again, it seems like, oh, the consequences are not as dire mechanically, maybe dire, or afford the opportunities for like fun role playing that they do in 5e that they do in. But you know, a special group of players could take the 5e and run with it, and be, you know, and get into, and I've been at a table where I had a really awesome DM who really, you know, showed that, right, that can happen, right? I mean, it becomes, and for some 5e players at that table, I was like, oh, this is really cool, because now I feel that weight of you know, weariness of travel, and the danger of shadow. But then some of the players at the table, like, oh, this isn't 5e, right, type of thing. So really, it really depends, right? And actually, one of my players did say, who hadn't played either system before, he said, I think I would probably like to try the other system. Because he felt that there was something, like, the story was great, right? The story that we were telling was really cool. But he just, he felt like, oh, man, I want to feel like the burden. I'm playing a ranger of the Dunedain, a dying people, really, until Aragorn steps up eventually. Sorry, spoiler for the Lord of the Rings.
What?
What?
Son of a bee.
Yeah. So, but you know, but he really wanted to feel like the burden that the Dunedain, like a Dunedain ranger of the North, would have, and he you know, he said, you know, I feel like, yeah. And he was cool. He had a great setup. He was like an orc hunter, you know, and very vengeful. And he really enjoyed, he felt like, cause he felt like he was he wanted to play like an angry guy, like full of vengeance, but that didn't come across as well as it could have come across in the One Ring game. Cause there weren't consequences for his like outburst.
Interesting. So one of the things, like, I don't know how you feel about it, but I kind of feel like, when we play these games, like, so they are games, right? So they have rules, but we're also trying to play a role. And I feel, at least that's how I feel it. And so I feel like when you're talking about the One Ring using the Free League system, that it really balances those two sides of the coin that is the role-playing game. Would you agree with that?
So, like, where the mechanics, well, I think the mechanics and the role playing opportunities feed into each other, right? The mechanics help with role playing opportunities. I mean, obviously you don't have to, right? And a lot of people will just go through the mechanics and go, okay, but you know, when I've played it, and maybe I just have the benefit of having really amazing players, or I've been in a group of amazing players playing the One Ring, but when I played it, like, it's tense, right? It's I like that. You like that. You want that feeling, right? You want that feeling, like, where people. So, fun anecdote here. You want that feeling in a game where. So I remember playing Call of Cthulhu, Dark Ages Call of Cthulhu, and the characters looked up and saw this body and blood, or so they saw blood dripping from the branches above. And then suddenly, like, I guess the air conditioner condensation dripped on the table, and people jumped because they were tense about the situation, right? So
yeah.
You want to be able to convey that. I think that's a fun a fun outcome in a role-playing session or game, right? That's it's tense, you know, you skin of your teeth that, you know, you to survive, and when you do get that, you know, a critical success, whether in, you know, a D20 based game or in the Freely game, when you roll a Gandalf and you get a piercing hit, take down the foe, you know, you're like, wow, we did it. And at the same time, when you know that, when you roll that that eye of Sauron on the dice, and you see that attention of Mordor ticking, you're like, oh man. So those were not in the really in the D&D 5e game, the sort of Eye of Mordor, which was interesting, right? I guess it just, you play the outcome, and or I don't know, or I just need to dive into it more. Maybe I'm missing something, but I don't recall this like accumulation of, you know, attention from the eye, right, type of thing, which also can add to tension.
Try not to buy more books, man, but you're really making me want to like go out and get the One Ring from Free League, because that sounds fantastic. So just to sort of round things out here, because I feel like we've had a really, really good conversation. I really feel like we've been, this is the kind of conversation that, you know, two nerd dudes who love role-playing games would have. Because this is a show that tries to help game masters, what piece of advice would you give either novice or veteran gamers to become better game masters?
If you don't already communicate regularly with your players, right? And really, I think through that communication, try to promote their player agency so that both, because the GM is going to have fun telling the story. I mean, I think, right? We have all these books, we have all these adventures. We make up these adventures and we want to see them to fruition, right? But you want to give the players agency so they don't feel, honestly, I think the worst feeling is when players are like, you can see around the table, the players feel like railroaded, like they had no choice in the matter. So case in point, so recently we're trying to finish up The Enemy Within, the grand campaign for Warhammer Fantasy. They've redone it for the fourth edition. I have all the editions and I love them all. Even the third edition Fiddly Bits one. But the fourth edition, once I'm reading through the adventure and they get to this event and the players have really worked their asses off. So can we say that on the show? Worked their asses off to set things up in the right way, that they got all their bases covered. But the bad guy, through the flow of the dice, still gets their opportunity. And I talked to the player, so in a way it could have felt like, well, we did all this stuff, but we lost our agency because it's going to happen anyway. But then we talked, but I made sure that the players, I mean I don't know if the players felt that way, but in talking to them, they did not feel that way, because they did do things, and I think the end result would have been a worse outcome. You know, if I had railroaded them, it would have been a worse outcome. But because of what they did, they were able to lessen the outcome, even though it was a pretty tough, powerful bad guy. And then in the end, they finally defeated this guy who had been a kind of a thorn in their side for like three books in a way, I think, or two books at least. No, three. Yeah. He got away at the end of one of the chapters, and they're like, ah, we got to find this guy. And they know he's been like doing stuff in the background for a little bit, and they finally got him. So, you know, but so I think, always communicating with your players and making sure you guys are both having fun, that they have agency, and that you're able to tell your story, right? Because I think that way you can both have fun. So communication, I guess that's it.
I wholeheartedly agree. I really feel like that's what the core of this hobby is when it comes down to it, right? Is having that communication with your players and touching base and making sure that, you know, you're not doing something that might be annoying them inadvertently, or, you know, that they're not able to express exactly what it is that they're trying to do. And I think just the fact that you recognized in that scenario that, hey, this is probably not going to, you know, jive with my players, making the attempt to make it, you know, more in line with what you were hoping they were going to be, you know, satisfied with. And then, you know, even though you realized in the end, oh man, it didn't really work out the way I wanted it to. I mean, you tried, right? I think that's what happens so often is, you know, how do you grow without that sort of quote unquote failure, right?
Yeah, I think that's true too. And I have another example recently. And you have to be, as a GM, you have to be humble enough to listen and maybe realize that, well, you maybe made a mistake or you didn't think this thing through, right? So I think another example is, and it, you might even see this on our YouTube channel, because I felt it was really contentious that the other players say, no, it's fine. You want people to see all our flaws and wrinkles, right? So there was an issue where I was like, oh, I want to play this really cool classic adventure, and I got these pre-gens, but as it turns out, the pre-gens were not adequate, even in the context of that adventure, because it effectively, while it's a classic adventure, a lot of these classic adventures, if you read them, are kind of railroads, right? Unfortunately. And you want to give players agency. I think it's very important, right? You want players to be able to feel like they have a say in what's going on. And hey, even if they die trying, they're going to die trying, right? So anyway, so that makes characters way less optimal than I think they should be to tackle the challenges. And one of the players realized this and said, and we just got pretty upset about their constant failures and not being able to do things. So we kind of paused, stopped, reevaluated, and then found an adequate solution, right? So we kind of, because I was playing using a modern rule set for an older game, and sometimes it doesn't really work, right? Because I had the mindset of like, well, this is the way the modern game goes, so this is what we would need, and the players just didn't have it. So we had to really reevaluate, you know. And I think if we had made characters from scratch, and probably even in the older system, if you had made characters from scratch, it would have been fine. But using the pre-gens, it seems like almost like, well, you know, run this as a tournament, here are these pre-gens, and then, you know, it's like, haha, we gotcha. You know, it almost seems that way, seeing the railroadiness of this adventure, which is unfortunate because I think it has some fantastic ideas in it. And it can come to a satisfying conclusion, you know, as you progress through it, right? But I think you need to, like, listen to your players, give them more agency, or like let them, you know, let them have that agency and be humble enough to, like, not, it's their story, right? You like to tell the story, but it's their story.
Exactly. Yeah. So this has been a great conversation. But I know you have a YouTube channel, you got your podcast. You want to plug that for the audience?
Yeah, please go head out to, you know, if you're watching this on YouTube, just jump over to the Geomologist Presents. I'm sure Jason will have that link in the show notes. I do a podcast and I do a YouTube channel. We put the podcast on the YouTube too. We sync them over, so you don't have to go to both places if you don't want to. But please like and subscribe. If you get over there, I think we do a lot of fun play, but I'm always trying to improve. So I don't mind comments. Hey, if you like, oh man, you got this rule totally wrong, whatever. People have said that. Oh, you don't know how to pronounce names in Middle Earth. Fine. I'll try next time. I'll try harder next time. So, you know, I try not to be sarcastic about it, but you know.
Yeah. Life on the internet, right?
Well, fortunately I have players that will correct me in game too. So, you know, it's great, but yeah, so it's fine. You know, comment. I do some unboxings, which I've been told this is the worst unboxing ever. And then another unboxing, this is the best unboxing ever. So, internet, YouTube, what can you do?
Yep, 100%, man. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time, your knowledge. It's been fantastic. And, you know, I feel like there's so much more that we could talk about. So at some point, I want to have you back and we'll cover some other burning game mastering topics.
Right. Great. That'd be awesome.
Awesome.
Thank
dude.
You so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have a game today, so good luck with that. And
it's one ring, actually.
Oh, there we go, man. Staying on brand. All right. Take care and we will chat later.
The
That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener! This is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that milk drinker Jason. We in the dungeon always appreciate whatever love you can give us. So please, share the podcast, send your messages, and do anything that will unclog our algorithm. We really appreciate it. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.